I'm Lauren Meltzer. The Bay Area has been the birthplace of many progressive movements over the course of history. No matter the sector, the people at the heart of these movements all have some things in common: passion, good timing, and tenacity. I had the good fortune to interview three pioneers whose initiatives and actions influenced the cultural, technological, and environmental landscape of the Bay Area. Some of their efforts can be seen in the Bay Area today. Other contributions have evolved into something new, while still other efforts have become an important part of the Bay Area's history. Please join me as I travel back in time and hear the stories and reflections of three Bay Area legends. Julius Blank, who has come to be known as one of the founders of Silicon Valley. Sylvia McLaughlin, who along with two other women helped push legislation to stop the San Francisco Bay from being developed into waterfront property. And Frank Jackson, who in the world of Bay Area music has been deemed a legend and pioneer for his active role in the Fillmore jazz era. The media dubbed Julius Blank and his seven colleagues the Traitorous Eight. Back in 1956, they did something extraordinary for that time. They left their jobs working for Nobel Prize winner William Shockley and secured $1.5 million to start their own company, Fairchild Semiconductor. Julius Blank, Victor Greenwich, Jean Hernie, Eugene Kleiner, Jay Last, Gordon Moore, Robert Noyce, and Sheldon Roberts created the equipment that could mass produce the first silicon integrated circuit. Blank's story as part of the group, as well as an individual, is why years later he's been cited as one of the founders of Silicon Valley. The work of Blank and his colleagues laid the groundwork for that of Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, and all the other tech entrepreneurs of today.
Growing up, I don't know, the word risk-taking, that's a new expression. We never used words like that. I mean, you grew up in an area where, it was difficult. There were difficult times. I grew up right in the middle of the Depression. And then right along after that came World War II. And so this was not a normal period. You had to do what you needed to do to make a living.
Julius was born in 1925. He was trained as an engineer and got a background in manufacturing at Western Electric. Later, through his friend and colleague Eugene Kleiner, he was brought to Shockley Labs, the primary lab to develop the first prototype silicon devices. I spoke with him about his life at Shockley Labs, the breakaway, and starting Fairchild. As he died only a few months after our conversation, this was one of his last interviews.
What was Shockley Labs like?
After being in a big company like Western Electric, this is a very primitive lab. It's right down the street here. If you drive by, you'll see it. It was a one-story building. It was just a shack, basically, you know, with tables and benches in it. And we had to build, you know, whatever we needed in right there or have someone else build it for us. And we had to do everything ourselves because, you know, you don't have the advantage of a big organization at your disposal, so... It was quite primitive.
William Shockley, Shockley Labs founder, and later known for sharing the Nobel Prize in Physics, had recruited to his lab the most creative team in the world for developing and producing transistors. By the end of the summer of 1956, Blank and his seven colleagues had all joined the lab. However, Shockley's management style and constant refocusing of his employees' efforts soon became a problem. By the beginning of 1957, Blank and the other Traitorous Eight would bond over leaving the lab.
He showed up at different times. I think maybe there was one or two of them ahead of me. I think maybe Sheldon Roberts was there first, and Greenwich, and Noyce showed up 3 days after I came in. By the end of the summer, we were all there.
Tell me about the departure of the group from Shockley, you know, the specific events that led up to actually leaving.
Well, when we decided that we had to put a stop to this change, this vacillation in project management, we got together and we decided we ought to do something about it. And so maybe we ought to, so we decided among us, and it was sort of an impromptu meeting that somebody ought to get a hold of Beckman. And I think it was Gordon Moore that was assigned that simply because he went to Caltech and Beckman was a trustee there. So at least he had some tie. And we wanted to make sure that there was a sizable enough group. So we made sure there was a critical mass, and that's how the eight of us got together. And so we had three or four times, I believe.
Beckman
came up. We had dinner with him. And we explained, and he understood what we were talking about. And he was going to have a manager from one of his other divisions. He had a division in Palo Alto that he had just acquired recently called the Spinko Division. They made medical equipment, mostly this ultra centrifuges for separating viruses and stuff like that. And he was going to get one of his managers from there to go ahead and oversee this one. And then he thought about bringing somebody in from the outside. So we interviewed a couple of people. And at the last minute, he came in and he told us that he wasn't going to do that. He wasn't going to remove Shockley.
You didn't want to start your own thing. You just wanted to get rid of Shockley?
We suggested that he get Shockley a chair at Stanford. And we wanted to use him as a technical advisor, a scientific advisor that we have access to, but not to run the day-to-day basis. Because he knew nothing about manufacturing, nothing about getting a product out the door, nothing about allocating resources to make sure this didn't happen, and in order to do that, you had to stop something else. And so just all the normal things you do to make something work. So at the last minute, he decided he wasn't going to do that. So that's when we started with, we got to figure a way out of this, because this is an untenable situation now. You got your bridges all burned. And so we talked about finding other jobs or working together with a company. Someone could say, well, why don't we present ourselves as a group? And, who are we going to talk to? So somebody decided we're going to talk to somebody. How about Wall Street? Turns out Gene Kleiner's father, Gene Kleiner had an uncle that was a broker of some sort at Hayden and Stone, which is an old-time securities house in New York. He wrote him a letter with Rose Kleiner's typewriter. You've probably seen pictures of that letter. And shortly, he showed it to his superior, boss, and decided he wanted to come out and take a look at this group. So they flew out here, and he met with us, and decided he's going to look for funding. Anyway, that's how it started. And we gave him a list of 30 or 35 companies that we carefully honed up. And he went to see all of them and got turned down by everyone. And that the reason he gave him, he said, well, we can't incorporate this group. We don't know how to incorporate it as part of our culture. It would interfere with it. And these are valid reasons. Or they say, yeah, we like the idea, but it's not something we don't see a future in, and we were ready to, terminate the discussion. And at the last minute, someone told Coyle, said, why don't you go see Sherman Fairchild uptown? He likes to dabble with things like this. It makes an appointment, goes to see him. And Sherman at the time was a very wealthy guy in his own right. His father, Sherman Fairchild Sr., founded IBM with the Watson family. And Sherman, through his inheritance, was the largest individual shareholder in IBM at that time. And so they went to see him, and it was a strange thing. This guy, in a very fancy, modern, townhouse on Upper Fifth Avenue, ultra-modern, really fit. I passed by it once some years later. And Sherman is sitting there. He's dunking his finger in a cup of water. He had an abscess on his finger. So he was dunking his finger in a cup of hot water with boric acid. And he's going over this proposal. 1.5-page double space proposal. The guys wanted $1.6 million or so, I forget the exact number, over $1 million to start a company. There's 8 guys leaving from a Nobel Prize winner. It sounded interesting. He said, let's take a look at it. So he sent his executive vice president, that was Richard Hodgson, out to look at it, and he looked at the, he introduced the group, and he interviewed it, and he said, let's go ahead and do it. And that was the way it happened. You know, nowadays you go to a venture capitalist and you come out with a big PowerPoint presentation with a big thick dossier full of pictures and a few words and projections going out for the next 25 years, you're going to make $1 trillion. I mean, it's the whole thing. This was a page and a half.
That was Julius Blank. I'm Lauren Meltzer, and you are listening to Bay Area Pioneers. You can learn about and share the program by going to kalw.org. When Blank and his colleagues got their money, they started Fairchild Semiconductor. They wanted to focus on creating transistors made with silicon, as opposed to germanium, a more expensive, harder-to-use material that was being used. They knew that silicon-diffused transistors would be a useful invention because of the limitations of germanium.
If there's ever going to be a mass market, there wasn't enough germanium mined on the Earth to satisfy that market. With silicon, there was plenty of. One of the most abundant materials around. And even though it was more difficult to work with, it had certain performance characteristics which were superior to anybody else. But I think the fundamental issue was that its availability. You start working with some weird substances, you know, the world supply is minuscule. Well, silicon, there's lots of it. It was very early in the game, and there weren't a lot of uses. Now, they were starting to be used in the military, not as silicon, but just semiconductors. And the first chance we got was to see if we could build, we didn't have it, it didn't exist yet, a silicon transistor for an IBM airborne computer. They were using germanium, but the environment in the aircraft was so severe that they had to reuse refrigerators to cool it, and they couldn't stand the weight penalty. So they had a choice of either using, you know, loading up with refrigerators or going using silicon. And IBM gave us an order to build devices for that without even knowing if we could build it or not. It was certainly a crapshoot on their part, because the Air Force insisted that they didn't want that weight penalty. Turned out it didn't matter because they canceled the program anyway, but by this time we showed it could be done. We got our first order and shipped the product 11 months after we walked in the door. Now, that doesn't happen today. We had to invent the equipment, invent the device, build it, and ship it. Oh.
When was the time when you thought, we can take this and create, or, you know, a integrated circuit? When did it switch to that?
I don't know if I could really pinpoint a time when that happened. Now, the idea of integrating it on one piece of silicon, they thought about it, but it had two very serious problems. One is isolating one device from the other, and the other is interconnecting the two. And there are others, but those are the two that stand out. And that problem hadn't been solved. The stuff that we came up with had to have an isolation device, which came from our planar patent that John Hernie developed. We did that for a different reason, just to make these silicon transistors work better. And when they had the idea of putting them together and interconnecting the two, there was an idea, but nobody actually made it yet. It was a nice drawing on a patent application, but nobody ever had actually built one yet. And we decided we started a project going that Jay Lass was running to just do just that. And I'll tell you, the first devices that came out of that were pretty ratty looking. But, you know, once you have to keep at it, and it took a while. But and then when you had it, you had no customers because they didn't want to buy it. They didn't know what it was. You were interfering with their business because, well, they're designers. They don't want to buy somebody else's design because then you're going to put me out of work. So it took a while. And then you had people who were saying that this device can't function because you have so many, the more devices you add on it, the less there is a mathematical chance that they're all going to be, you know, at the same spec at the same time. But there's a mathematician's talking. You know, they looked at it like interconnecting a whole bunch of individual devices. Now, you're going to do that with a few hundred, but with 6 billion, you're not going to do that. You haven't got time to fiddle with it. You have to make the whole thing work as a unit.
One of the areas that Blank was in charge of at Fairchild was offshore manufacturing.
I got a call from Noyce one day, and he said, you know, you ought to go and take a look at Hong Kong, because we knew we were going to run out of assembly workers to build discrete devices. The integrated circuits were just coming up online, and we wanted to find a cheaper place to build these things. So you have to remember, the Valley at that time did not have an inexhaustible supply of labor. The type of labor that was required to build semiconductors required the ability to look through a microscope and have very dexterous fingers. Okay. Now, you're not going to do this with people that are throwing clay pots all day long or doing some rough farm work. You need people that are used to doing weaving, knitting, this kind of thing, needlework, that kind of thing, that have the patience to look through a microscope all day long. So the supply, and they're mostly women because you have to sit in one place. Okay, so that sort of naturally lends yourself to that. Just from a biological point of view, you know, it's hard to get certain male types to sit in one seat all day long. They just don't have enough meat to be able to sustain themselves. I get what you do with them. And so that led to the fact you had to have a lot of women. They were just running out of women here. So he decided to take a look at Hong Kong only because he had a friend of his was an airline pilot for Pan American that was telling him about this. And so he asked me and Charlie Spork to go and make a trip to Hong Kong and see if we could do that. Well, we did, and we decided, well, it was worth a shot. There were a lot of women there available because they were just floating down the Pearl River. Labor was very cheap. There were a lot of them.
Well, what are you most proud of when you think back on those years?
Gee, I don't even know if I can answer that. Well, I was very lucky to be part of a group like this. That doesn't happen often, or maybe once in a lifetime. It's hard to explain. In a room where everybody's working and four or five different things at once, and you start conversations back and forth with different people, pick them up at different times, and nobody loses a step. And all of a sudden, somebody had come out with some weird thing that he wanted done, and we find a way to do it. And one thing I appreciate of that, quite often, I was allowed to, to work unsupervised. Nobody knew what to do anyway. They couldn't tell me because nobody knew anymore. So I was left to my own devices. Well, you grow up pretty quick when you have that much responsibility, especially if you want to do it right.
And do you think that in terms of the work ethic that your group had, do you think that it's the same as it is now with Silicon Valley and the entrepreneurial environment?
I don't know what it is now. It's quite different. I hear these stories of what's happening at Google or what happened at other companies where they have these free lunches and all the perks and everything. Gee, we never had anything like that. We used to go out and buy lunch at our own nickel. I mean, the fact that you have to give things like that, well, I guess it's nice. But somehow or other, I can't see where that really helps any. You know, people talk about innovation, which is one of my pet peeves. There's very little innovation going on these days. Oh, there's improvements being made on what's been around, but nothing fundamentally new that strikes you. Okay, so Apple comes out with an iPod or an iPad, but it's the same stuff that's been around. Nothing different, just shaped a little differently. Maybe they use different materials, but the ones and zeros are going the same way.
So, if you had any advice to give to this generation of wannabe entrepreneurs, wannabe inventors, what would your advice be?
I tell you, I wouldn't want to give anybody advice like that, because that's something that's a very personal matter. It depends on what your goals are. If you want to make a lot of money, that's one. You do one thing. If you just want to do something striking and do something unique, that's another technique.
What about for those that are trying to do the striking and unique?
Learn as much as you can about as many things as you can handle, especially the fundamentals. Mama Nature, don't screw around with Mama Nature. Understand, she's a tough lady, but don't think you're going to get away with anything.
That's Julius Blank. I'm Lauren Meltzer. You are listening to Bay Area Pioneers, conversations with Bay Area elders who have been at the start of progressive movements. For the next part of this program, I speak with environmentalist Sylvia McLaughlin and jazz legend Frank Jackson.
What is this thing called love? This funny thing called love. Why does it cause a mystery? And why does it make a fool of me?
Walking through San Francisco's Fillmore District today, you would see little evidence of the neighborhood that was there 60 years ago. Indeed, during and after World War II, in the 1940s and 50s, the Fillmore was coined as the Harlem of the West, as it was alive with nightclubs and music.
What is this thing?
Jazz performers such as Ella Fitzgerald, Louis Armstrong, and Billie Holiday entertained people of all colors in night spots such as Bop City, the Long Bar, and the Blue Mirror, breaking down some of the racial segregation of the time. There in the mix was Frank Jackson, who worked as the house pianist at San Francisco's Bop City. Musicians from all over would drop in at Bop City during the Fillmore heyday. Being in the house band, Frank got a chance to associate with many of the jazz greats, including Charlie Parker, Billie Holiday, Ben Webster, Ella Fitzgerald, Nat King Cole, John Coltrane, Miles Davis, Quincy Jones, Dizzy Gillespie, Louis Armstrong, and others. Frank made San Francisco's jazz history in his own right, earning the title of the 2005 Lifetime Achievement Honoree by radio stations KPFA, KCSM, KKUP District. Although the Fillmore as it existed was demolished as part of a failed urban renovation project, its oral history is alive. I had the honor of speaking with Frank Jackson about his experiences as well as life during the Fillmore jazz era years.
I used to sing in church. I always did. And my mother was my sponsor. She would always egg me on to sing in church. And I didn't mind with the congregation, but I didn't want to sing solo. I had to get up and stand up and sing in front of everybody, and I knew everybody there, and it was frightening as a kid even. But I loved it. I loved music. I listened to the radio constantly, and I learned a lot of songs from radio. And the only musical instrument we had in the house was my dad's guitar, and he played a different type of thing than I was listening to. I liked music from the Hit Parade and a lot of other programs. I listened to blues programs, cowboy music, and I just had a desire to learn things. And I learned a lot of songs that I probably haven't ever used, but they were there, and I memorized them. We came out here during the war, and my dad and my older brother, my only brother, worked in the shipyards at Bethlehem Steel here. So then the whole family came out, and I was in school, and my nephew, my oldest sister's kid, we grew up, we were 2 years apart in age, and we grew up together like brothers, and that was it. The family was always together, and we've lived in San Francisco since then. I wanted to play piano for myself. There in Texas, we didn't have one. There was a church piano that every now and then I had a chance to touch. And so I started teaching myself. And even after I came here, I worked weekends and after school. And then I saved my money, and it was just to get a piano. So finally, I got a piano from Sherman & Clay. It was an upright, an old upright that was a player, and they took all of that equipment out of it. And the piano was $35 and $5 a week. And I got my first piano.
Can you tell me a little bit about what walking down the street in the 1940s and 50s felt like in the Fillmore neighborhood?
It was sort of magical. They had so many clubs, and there was small clubs, but there was entertainment in just about every one of them. Even some of the small bars had a piano, a player, and there was the Blue Mirror, which was one of the more well-known clubs that everybody came to. Black and White, they'd come from downtown to there. Ella would go in. After Ella, she would, there was a time when they couldn't work at the Fairmont. And so they worked in the Fillmore District. And then that changed, but prior to that, they did. But in the Fillmore, everybody worked together, and it didn't matter, because musicians didn't care about black or white. They just cared about, were they compatible?
It was in this lively scene that Frank Jackson played himself into the mix. Because he could sing and play the piano, he had an advantage. But it didn't happen without hard work.
I worked awful hard, and I was my worst critic. And so that kept me on my toes, trying to learn as much as I could and try and fit in with the musicians that I played with. And I learned a lot from doing that. And along the way, you help others who are maybe a little bit behind you. And you're getting advice and help from those who are beyond you. And it's just a workshop.
Did you have a mentor for you back then?
Oh, Ben Webster. I met him in Bop City, and they would come in after their gigs downtown. Most of them worked at the Black Hawk, and they would come in, and I met Ben. He was staying at the Booker T. Washington Hotel on Ellis Street. That was one of the black hotels here, and they had in the lounge, they had a piano and bandstand set up for entertainment. And in the kitchen, they had this a white piano that was back on the side. It was a big room back there. And we would get off from at 6 o'clock when Bop City closed. I'd go up to the hotel. They'd take me up there with them and go back. And Ben taught me a lot of tunes. He and Stuff Smith, the violinist, when Stuff was in town, he did the same thing. He said, "Come on with me," and they would teach me things back there. They said they liked my enthusiasm, the energy I had, and they could see that I wanted to learn, and I was never humiliated by the fact that somebody was better. Because I said, "They're better. They'll make me better." It helped me. Rather than be egotistical and saying, "Well, you know, I don't want them to think that I'm not good." But
Did you find that you were unique in that way, or were most of the young musicians like you?
A lot of them were like that. And we were all scared. So we had that in common. And some would, but just a few of them just gave up. They said, well, I can't do this. I'm never going to do this. And once in a while, I would say that to myself, but it never stopped me. I would say that, and then I'd go right on and push ahead and try and learn more and more.
In addition to Ben Webster, Frank played with a lot of other jazz giants, including Charlie Parker, a.k.a. Bird.
And I was crazy about him. I met Bird through a tenor saxophone player. And we were living in an apartment building. And this lady had nobody in there but musicians. And he and Bird were very, very good friends. Edwards. Teddy Edwards. And so Teddy and I had, we had rooms right next to each other. Teddy had a piano, and I had one. There was another piano player, a friend of mine, who had one. And so one afternoon, Bird came up to see Teddy, and Teddy brought him in and introduced me to him. And we talked, and it was really, really, really something. He was a very intelligent man, very, very intelligent, very well-read, and completely different from what you would think a lot of jazz musicians would. He didn't use a lot of jazz slang, anything. He just, he was regular, but he was very educated. And the way he played and the stuff he played, you would say, well, you know, he's just a jazz musician, but a great one.
Frank Jackson also played with Dizzy Gillespie.
Diz was off the bandstand. He would keep you laughing. And at Bob City, a lot of times we had rehearsals in the afternoon. And he would come down because it was he and a lot of the other musicians, because they liked Jimbo. Everybody knew him all over. And so they would come down to see him and talk to him. And Dizzy was there one day, and across the street was a pool hall. And he liked to shoot pool just for the fun of it, and he wasn't very good. So we'd go over there, and I'd beat him. And Diz would say, hey, Frank, look over there. And he'd push some balls in. I said, Diz, you're cheating. He says, no, I wouldn't do that.
And, love it.
He was fun, but on the bandstand, it was a different thing. He was very strict, and it really paid off for him because he had a wonderful orchestra.
Frank Jackson also played with Nat King Cole.
Nat was my idol.
Your idol.
For singing. You know, I said, if I could sing and play at the same time like that. And I said, I'm never going to be able to do this. I would try, and at first I had to concentrate on playing or concentrate on singing. And finally I got to where I could put the two together. I could sing, and then I could play fill-ins for myself while I was doing it like Nat. And I didn't realize I was doing it. And I was talking to somebody about it, a musician. And he said, I said, I'd like to be able to play and play fill-ins like Nat without having to think about it or worrying about it. He says, you're doing that. And after that, I paid a little bit of attention to it, and I said, I am. I had put it together and didn't realize it.
How old are you right now?
I'm 85.
And so you've seen, you know, it. You were there at the beginning of the Fillmore when it was thriving, as you mentioned. And,
yes.
And you watched it. It's go through a lot of changes.
A lot of changes.
Not always good changes.
No, it went from all those clubs to none. And with the promise that it was going to be rebuilt, which never happened until Yoshi's. Then clubs started coming back there, and I would say it's changed. It's changed in a good way, but there's still room for improvement a lot, and I think it's being done. And I'm proud of the fact that it's happening, because I saw it go from great to nothing, and then to be here to see that it's being rebuilt, and it's delightful.
What do you think people learned from the era, that Fillmore era? What lessons were learned, or what was taken out, and what do you see as a thread, if you will, of?
Well, to a lot of people, and to the musicians too, it was such a loss, and such a thing that really hurt, because people needed that. They needed it, and it should never have been destroyed. Even that whole Fillmore thing, where the homes were demolished with the promise of rebuilding a new Fillmore district. And it just fizzled. And there was talk about whether it was intended to be that way, or was it just an excuse to destroy it? And that remains a question mark in my mind. But you can't keep dwelling on something like that. So the musicians moved on to other areas, because a lot of barriers had opened up then. So it changed a lot of places where musicians worked. I also didn't mention the fact that there were two musician unions. There was the black local, and then there was the white local downtown. They were both in the same facility. We had a very small space and a little office. And finally, they merged, and it became one local. So right away, we thought, a lot of us did, that it's going to be a big change. We're going to get more jobs. And actually what happened was we lost some of the jobs we had, because they went into the pot. So in a lot of cases, we had less work. Instead of the whole thing opening up, we didn't get that.
So do you think that, I mean, the whole like 40s, 50s Fillmore era, was sometimes it's called the lost era. But do you think it really was lost, or do you feel like San Francisco today is what it is in some way because of that era, that historical era?
In a lot of ways, I think it is the lost era, because even with what's happening now, it'll take a long time for it to develop into what it was. Of course, it's not going to be exactly the same thing, and it may not be with the same feeling. I don't think you can get that, because that was in that time that was needed, and people band together for enjoyment and for entertaining too. So it was a two-way thing, where people needed it and the musicians needed it, and the two came together. You know, you go and you play in a house where everybody's having fun. So the musicians do too. It's great. But you can have a full house that's cold. And a lot of musicians say, well, I don't care. I do what I do. Of course you do, but you can enjoy it much more when you look out there and you see people happy and patting their foot and smiling about what you're doing. It doesn't mean that they're sitting there quiet, like, you know, they can talk, and that never bothered me. You hear some glasses clinging, and it's just a good feeling. I used to close my eyes and play, and I'd listen to that. And it just went together. It was a happiness thing for everybody. And we all need that. We still need that.
And have you taken that with you, even though without the neighborhood? Are you still, is
yes.
that still with you?
Yes, that's the way I feel.
That's Bay Area legend Frank Jackson. I'm Lauren Meltzer. You're listening to Bay Area Pioneers, conversations with Bay Area elders who have made an impact on Bay Area history. You can learn about and share this program by going to kalw.org.
That makes the lonely winter seem long.
People call you a legend.
I don't know why.
Was there one time when you really thought, okay, I've made it?
No. 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 I've been a lot of times, even now, I'm comfortable with it. You know, I said, well, you know, there's the possibilities that, you know, I'm doing okay, but I've got so much more to do. And that is an encouraging thing for me, too. I said, now I'm doing this, but I've got to do that. I've got to keep going because you're constantly hearing things that you want to add on to things and you feel things. And sometimes on the bandstand, things will sneak up on you. You know, I said, where did I get that from? And then sometimes you lose it. You know, I'll get home and I'll say, I'll work on that. Then I can't find it again. And then it'll come back and pretty soon I find it.
Let me talk about some of your songs that you perform. Now, you're a singer.
Yes.
You're a pianist. Mm-hmm. And you do some writing on your own.
Mm-hmm.
Yours, I'll be always. So foolishly yours. Nothing can change me. I'm yours. Tried other lips, other arms, but what for? It's you I adore, so I come back for more.
Foolishly Yours is from your New York After Dark album. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I've always loved the song. That was on my New York After Dark album with Ron Carter, Billy Pierce, Kenny Washington, the drummer, and James Williams, the pianist. James isn't with us now. James is deceased, but James was a good friend. And that was the band, Ron Carter, who is the most recorded jazz bassist in the world. And I knew about Ron, and I had never met him. I said, wow, I kept the way he played, so colorful. We were talking earlier about supporting a singer. And I never knew that, never thought that I would be singing with him. And so James set that up, and we did it at Systems 2, the studio in Brooklyn. And I really enjoyed it. I had a booth right next to Ron. I could see him right there. And we had eye contact every now and then, and that's just... I was just amazed. I said, boy, it's Ron Carter right there, you know. And I enjoyed so much singing. And this was one of the songs that I really, really like.
I'm so foolishly yours. Can't live without you. I'm so foolishly yours.
There are a lot of musicians these days that are trying to break in. What advice would you give young musicians?
To practice and to go and hear other musicians when you can. And try and enjoy what you're doing. And learn as much as you can. And it's so important to listen to other musicians. I mean, really listen to them. Not saying... I can do that, or I should do that. I can do it more than that, or I'm doing less than that. Just listen and learn and practice and enjoy it.
That's Frank Jackson. You can still hear him play at clubs around the Bay Area. He has a regular gig at Castanola's in Fisherman's Wharf. I'm Lauren Meltzer. You are listening to Bay Area Pioneers, conversations with Bay Area elders who have made an impact on the Bay Area history. My interviews are with high-tech pioneer Julius Blank, jazz legend Frank Jackson, and environmentalist Sylvia McLaughlin. You can find out more and share this program at kalw.org.
So it's been an interesting life work, you might say. Also, like keeping house, you like to have a nice, neat house. So the Bay Area is an extension of the house. It's your home. So you want to have your home be as nice as it can be.
The year was 1961. While many housewives might have been contemplating what to serve for dinner, Sylvia McLaughlin, along with her friends Kay Kerr and Esther Gulick, had something bigger on their minds. The question of why dump trucks were unloading trash along the East Bay coastline and what they could do to stop this. Indeed, in an era before strict environmental laws, the three women helped stop development of the bay, pushing through the formation of the Bay Conservation and Development Commission and a Save the Bay bill, which passed in 1969 as the McAteer-Petras Act. Now in her mid-90s, her organization, Save the Bay, celebrated its 50th anniversary in 2011. From her living room in the Berkeley Hills, Sylvia shared a few memories about what brought her out here and what it took back then to make an observation into a law. Far from the coastline, Sylvia McLaughlin spent her youth in Denver, Colorado. Her father and mother were very involved in beautifying and giving back to their city. Her mother was instrumental in the development of the Denver Symphony, and her father, Denver's manager of the Parks and Improvement Department, developed Red Rocks, the first outdoor amphitheater. Although she clearly had a role model of a mother who didn't stick to the traditional female role of the time, I asked her if she and her brothers were treated differently.
I don't think I was treated any differently.
Did you grow up thinking?
I tried to follow them around.
Did you grow up thinking that you could do whatever they did, or did you?
Yes, of course.
Okay.
It made my mother a little nervous. She spoke once of seeing me going around the garden wall, which I guess is about as wide as that.
6 feet tall?
Following my brothers. Anyway.
When Sylvia was 14 years old, she was introduced to her father's colleague, Don McLaughlin. Don was a geologist from Harvard who was consulting on a mine her father was interested in. Don became a family friend, visiting every few years. Then, years later, Sylvia noticed Don in a different way and told her parents that he was someone she was really interested in. They got married. Don, a dean and later regent at UC Berkeley, brought Sylvia with him to Berkeley, an event that would change the course of Sylvia's life. Shortly after arriving, Sylvia started activist work and eventually started Save the Bay.
What prompted your desire to help Save the Bay? Did you read something? Did you see something?
Well, yes. We could see it being filled in right from here.
Right
and,
from here.
And you drive up past, you can see the dump trucks going down.
So tell me more, that dump trucks would come with just dump from... From
dump
what?
Along the shoreline.
And dump just garbage?
Yes. And, if they'd be excavating for another building, they'd go down and fill the bay. And all along the shoreline. And essentially there would have been another city of Berkeley where the water is. And we preferred to look at the water, so... that's how I got involved in that one.
Being the wife of senior Berkeley faculty, Sylvia was introduced to Kay Kerr, the wife of the president of UC Berkeley.
And we said we were both very concerned with, because there had been this article in the Oakland Tribune about the filling of the bay. And so we said we were both very concerned about this. And so she said, well, Esther Gulick is concerned also, so I should call up Esther. I didn't know Esther, but I called her up. And then three of us met out at Kay's, and So then Kay called a meeting of all the leading conservationists at that time. David Brower from the Sierra Club and the Save the Redwoods League. And they were the leading environmental organizations at that time. There were about 10 or 12 people came to this meeting, and they all said yes. Kay said that, told about what was being done to the bay, and they said yes. We agree that something should be done, but we're all busy, you know, saving the trees or saving this or saving and so then David Brower said, I think there should be another organization. So they filed out and wished us well. And then the three of us sat down and started Save the Bay. Save San Francisco Bay Association, and now it's pretty much shortened to Save the Bay. And it was largely a matter of educating people, because all around the bay, the cities had plans to fill, or the companies had plans to fill, or corporations and so on. And so we sort of did a big educational campaign, and Kay would do most of the writing, and I would be the one that would be sent out to talk at these various meetings, all kinds of League of Women Voters groups, this group and that group. And Esther kept the books, kept us solvent, and attended to the details. She was very shy and reserved, so I was kind of pushed forward. Kay never went out and spoke. And so I was kind of the one that was delegated to be the spokesperson, I guess you would say.
Had you done that before? Did you have any experience?
I didn't have a clue. But, you know, you do something and you get used to it. I think it was largely making people aware of what we had out in the bay and the shoreline, and helping people be aware and appreciating it.
Did you find people weren't aware, or they just didn't?
Took it for granted.
Indeed, the support was out there. As one of the group's first efforts, they asked 1,000 members for $1 donations and received 900 responses. Later, the group was heralded for being California's first modern grassroots environmental movement. The women were asked to go around the country explaining their strategy.
What would you tell them? What would you tell them how you did it?
Well, to get a lot of allies, both groups and individuals, is very important. Put together all the lists we had. I had a lot of different lists. I still collect lists of people. And we'd send a letter to join Save the Bay out to just a one-pager first to all these various lists of people that we had to join the organization. So that's how we got a big sort of a backup group of informed people that we send out letters to our membership occasionally, keeping them up to date on what was going on.
Did you and Esther and Kay always see eye to eye?
Interesting question. To be perfectly honest, no. But I think we did sort of kind of govern by consensus. We made decisions by consensus. I didn't always agree with various. Kay, Esther usually just would agree with whatever Kay felt was right. And if I differed a little bit, we'd usually work things out.
Your admirers have described you as patient and polite.
Well, I always thought it's important to be polite. You get farther, I think. There's no sense in not being polite. But I never thought of myself as being particularly patient.
What about a good listener?
I think we just did what we thought was important, really. And if it took a while, it took a while. And you just did what you felt was right and important to do to achieve your goals. So it's an ongoing issue, I think. That's why what we're still trying to tell people, that if they want the beauty of the Bay Area, they have to be ever vigilant and make sure that it's the people are taking care of it, are working at it, and not just letting the developers always have their way.
So were there any names of people called you along the way that you had to laugh at?
Oh, that called me different names? Oh, yeah. I think I put down a couple for the eco-freaks and environmaniacs. No, you just laugh.
Did you get any negative press? Like, what are these crazy ladies doing?
We must have. There was this group, the West Bay Committee Associates, that was just on the opposite side of the fence. That were, David Rockefeller was part of that group. And they wanted to have an island out in the bay and fill a lot of the bay and so on. They thought that would be advantageous to, that would be progress for the city of San Francisco. We did not agree. And then finally, I went to an event in Orinda, and David Rockefeller was there, and he held out his hand and shook hands with my hand. He said, "Well, you won." I thought that was pretty nice.
How do you think that your efforts have helped just the water resources around the Bay Area, just in general? Do you think that this initial effort to save the Bay has how much of an impact?
I think it helped make people more aware of the importance of water resources. Well, I think it drew people's attention to the importance of the Bay from many different aspects. I mean, there's fishing, there's fishery, there's the beauty of the, really, why we did it was because of its beauty. That's why we became involved. And so many issues that are unique to this bay. But what I'm most proud of, I think, as I say, is the achieving the Microtear-Petras Act, making it permanent. And it was pretty exciting to be in Sacramento and one of these big member of the Senate hearings, and Esther and I were just holding hands, you know, while they were voting. And we won by one vote.
Do you have any advice for people who might see a real issue that needs to be solved today?
Well, you have to have determination and, well, maybe the patience, persistence. Sense of humor helps, and I think a clear idea of what you want to achieve.
Sylvia McLaughlin can now look out the window and enjoy the view she worked so hard to preserve. You've been listening to Bay Area Pioneers. You can learn about and share this program at kalw.org. Special thanks to Matt Martin for his oversight of this program. Bay Area Pioneers was engineered by Seth Samuel. For KALW, this is Lauren Meltzer.
You can hear this program again tomorrow night at 9 o'clock here on KALW San Francisco, 91.7 FM. It is City Visions. We'll be back next Monday at its usual time.
Tune in for Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence.
Coming up, identities lost and found in a global age.
You can leave home, but you can't leave the identity it provides.
Nonsense, Ken. Free people are at home wherever they choose to live, and they should choose their identities too.
John, spoken with the true naivete of a rootless American.
Identities lost and found on Philosophy Talk, Tuesday at noon on KALW 91.7.
Philosophy Talk tomorrow at noon. KALW has a free email newsletter. Join more than 7,000 of your fellow listeners who get an email every week or two to keep them aware. aware of the diverse programming on local public radio, as well as opportunities to participate in station events. Just click the email newsletter link on the front page of our website, kalw.org. It's 8 o'clock, and time now for As It Happens from the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation in Toronto.
Hello, I'm Rick McInnes-Ray, sitting in for Carol Off.
Good evening, I'm Jeff Douglas. This is As It Happens. Tonight,
the comeback kid. Enrique Peña Nieto claims victory in Mexico's presidential election, but with him, a political party with a reputation for authoritarian rule and corruption.
Hook, line, and sunk. Looking back at 20 years of the cod moratorium and ahead to see whether we can bank on the fishery's return.
Out of Africa, a team from the International Criminal Court is released from custody in Libya after weeks of tense negotiations.
It's asbestos time. Hopefully it won't become the worst of times. The Quebec government pledges millions to restart the province's controversial Jeffrey mines.
He takes a licking, he keeps on trucking. Last week we told you about the lone ice cream truck driver in Yellowknife. Turns out